loud, and as such, that shockwave in air, which when it's big enough can be very destructive, it created a thousand injuries of people, lots of broken glass, and smashed doors, and damaged walls of buildings and whatever. Lots of damage took place in Russia because of that impact. And some of those pieces of that meteor became a meteorite. That means that they survived the whole impact and overheating of the atmosphere, didn't completely melt and vaporize, and pieces of it hit the ground. And so your question is, who collects that? Amateurs, scientists, sometimes NASA officials, sometimes your local police force, sometimes the CIA, the FBI, anybody there who has an official hat of some kind is going to try to collect the material and try to bring it to the scientists who would love to be able to bring it to a laboratory, analyze it, and find out, is it carbonaceous chondrite? In other words, is it one of the kinds of materials that's been in space for a million years since collecting solar wind, and that tells you something about the primordial materials that came into this particular solar system that became the cloud of materials around the sun that formed the sun, the star that we call the sun, and eventually formed the planet. So there's a lot of good technical knowledge you can get by collecting meteorites. So your question sort of is, who do you call? And I don't know the answer to that. Let's see what Paul's got to say. Paul, to your knowledge, our space expert, is there a particular society, is there a particular organization that has published a telephone number that is supposed to be
repeater, timeout,
so are you saying there wasn't a sonic boom?
Hold on now. Do I have it there? Yes, you do. I'm asking Paul, who is the person that you, I guess there certainly was a sonic boom, without a doubt. The thing was hitting at very high supersonic velocities, so it may call it a sonic boom, call it an explosion, call it an impact with the atmosphere, call it a drastic overheated shockwave, give it any words you like. It's got a lot of heat and volume and noise and pressure, and as it gets bigger and bigger, it eventually is going to make a hole in the ground like Meteor Crater in Arizona, if you know what I mean. Now, that's a once per 10,000 year event or something like that. But once per 100 years, we get one like the Tunguska event in Russia, way around, I think it was around 1905 or so. And now you got this one in 2013. So, to your knowledge, Paul, is there an organization that has been assigned the task of collecting the materials for scientific purposes when a civilian says, hey, I got something in my backyard? WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW in the technet. Go ahead, Paul. Wait for the beeps.
Yeah, I think he's talking about, I think it's Kinnenberg. Begins with a K. In Pennsylvania years ago, and the military showed up and they cordoned off the area. There were always rumors that maybe it was a UFO and all of that. So he's probably asking, you know, what do they do if something falls out of the sky? Well, if anything falls out of the sky and they get a report on it, naturally, if you show up and there it is, you're there first. But after you make that call, you know, they're going to show up and they want to find out what it is. Is it a meteor? Okay, that could be one thing, but it could be a satellite, and it could be part of a spy satellite. Either our own or somebody else's. They're going to cordon off that area, and whether or not you think it was a UFO or not that came down, that's up to you. But that's usually what's going to happen there. And there was a case up in Canada, let me drop it. Satellite came flying out of the sky. Cosmos had four numbers behind it, six something or other. I'll have to look it up. Now, that had radioactivity on board, you know, so Canadian government cordoned off that area. They weren't going to let anybody near it. Possible endangerment of getting radiated, but that's usually the case. But if you go back to the fellow with the initial question, this place that's sponsored the letter K in Pennsylvania is probably late 1950s or maybe early 1960s, back in the day.
Yeah, it's very, the word that got dropped out that I heard on the input that didn't come through right away, that Paul was talking about a Russian satellite three decades ago, which in order to have a very long-lasting power supply, had a nuclear power supply on the satellite. And in those early days, they were not quite as smart of designing nuclear power supplies to make them quasi-indestructible on reentry. Therefore, that Russian satellite did reenter in northern Canada, smeared a lot of radioactive material across the land, and that had to be collected because it represented a biohazard. The modern-day power supplies that are put on things like a Curiosity spacecraft that now this object that's walking across Mars, if during that launch that particular launch vehicle failed and that thing re-entered the Earth's atmosphere and that nuclear power supply experienced the heating of re-entry and the impact with the ground, that power supply was designed to be so sturdy that that package wouldn't break open. And the worst case scenario is what the design was trying to do, so that your radioactive materials inside would be confined. So modern design makes nuclear power supplies on satellites and spacecraft a hell of a lot safer than they would some time ago. When it comes to a UFO landing in your backyard, I don't know who you call in that particular case, but the chances of it happening to any of us are so darn slight. Close encounter of the third kind, very, very unlikely. My family has seen things in the sky that are difficult to explain, but nothing that I could bother reporting to anybody. Maybe this is some of the information you're looking for, Joe number two. KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey, K2LIW in the Tech Nat.
Hey, Roger. Yeah, I was just curious about that stuff. Anything, falling from space. So I guess what I'll do is, first thing is, dial 911 and report it and let them handle it, And, yeah, thank you for all the help. Back to you.
Hey, with a comment? Okay, that was a triple. Some of that, I think, was Paul. Let me start up with Paul first. WS2N, go ahead, Paul.
Trying to find out from Joe if you remember the place that he's talking about. I thought it was the letter K in Pennsylvania, Clintonville or something. I forget it. I can't remember the name of it. Did it start with the letter K? Do you remember that?
Joe, do you happen to remember the name of the place in Pennsylvania?
Pittsburgh.
Did you say Pittsburgh? You have to key the mic, wait a second, and then start talking. Joe again, go ahead.
Yeah, that was somebody else. I think the other station out there said Pittsburgh. I don't remember. All I remember was Pennsylvania.
Pittsburgh, Kilo Echo, Charlie, Kilo, Sierra, Bravo, Uniform, Romeo, Golf.
Okay, spell it the right way now. Spell it without phonetics, very slowly. Did you say Pittsburgh or something like that? Go ahead.
K2H, Kecksburg, K-E-C-K-S-B-U-R-G, Kecksburg, Kilo Echo, Charlie, Kilo.
Yeah, that was it then.
Okay, and Lou, roughly what year was that event, and roughly what was the object? Lou, you seem to remember it quite well. How big was the object? Roughly what year in Kecksburg was it meteorite, if that's what it was? You got it, NY2H, K2LIW, with the net.
I have no recollection. They wipe my memory banks. Now, seriously, I just Googled and found this. I have no clue. Well, I can read it, but, 1965, though, seems to be the year.
They chased everybody away. That was it. They went away with this thing under a big top and all. And there's all kinds of witnesses saying that it was a UFO.
Whoa. And so, were the men in black there, Paul? Were the Black Hawk helicopters and men in black cordoning off the area and collecting the material and quietly spearing it away in right? What's your recollection on that one? Paul first, and then Lou in that order. WS2N, KQLIW.
Seen a couple of reports about this, yeah, Keckberg. It's like the Roswell of the East, you know. All the Palmers and everybody, they're going to say it was, you know, some UFO, and it was a big cover-up, and why was the military there, and they wouldn't let anybody near it. Even when they pulled it away, you couldn't even be near the road when the thing left. On. It's the Roswell of the East. Back to you, Victor.
Very fine, Paul. Lou, what's your recollection of it? Because I'm having trouble remembering this one. They wiped out my memory also. QS2H, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'll give you a couple of words from Wikipedia. Because as I say, I never heard of it. I just Googled it. The Keksberg UFO incident occurred on December 9, 1965 at Keksberg, Pennsylvania. A large, brilliant fireball was seen by thousands in at least six U.S. states and Ontario, Canada. It streaked over the Detroit, Michigan, Windsor, Ontario area, reportedly dropped hot metal debris over Michigan and northern Idaho, starting some grass fires, and caused sonic booms in western Pennsylvania. It was generally assumed and reported by the press to be a meteor after authorities discounted other proposed explanations such as a plane crash, air and missile test, or re-entering satellite debris. Let me let it drop. However, eyewitnesses in the small village of Keksberg, about 30 miles southwest of Pittsburgh, claim something crashed in the woods. A boy said he saw the object land. His mother saw a wisp of blue smoke arising from the woods and alerted authorities. Another reported feeling a vibration and a thump about the time the object reportedly landed. Others from Keksberg, including local volunteer fire department members, reported finding an object in the shape of an acorn and about as large as a Volkswagen Beetle. Writing resembling Egyptian hieroglyphics was also said to be in a band around the base of the object. Witnesses further reported that intense military presence, most notably the United States Army, secured the area, ordered civilians out, and then removed the object on a flatbed truck.
And does Wikipedia tell you what happened next? This is a beautiful mystery. What's your guess as to what happened next, Lou? And thank you for this research. NY2H, go right ahead, K2RIW.
The Tribune Review from nearby Greensburg had a reporter at the scene. The headline in the newspaper the next morning was, "Unidentified Flying Object Falls Near Keksberg, Army Ropes Off Area." The article continued with, "The area where the object landed was immediately sealed off on the order of U.S. Army and state police officials, reportedly in anticipation of a close inspection of whatever may have fallen. State police officials there ordered the area roped off to await the expected arrival of both U.S. Army engineers and possibly civilian scientists. However, a later edition of the newspaper stated that nothing reportedly had been found after authorities searched the area. The official explanation of the widely seen fireball is that it was a mid-sized meteor. However, speculation as to the identity of the Keksberg object, if there was one, reports vary, also range from it being an alien craft to debris from Cosmos 96, a Soviet space probe intended for Venus but never left the atmosphere. Similarities have been drawn between Keksberg and Roswell, leading to the former being referred to as Pennsylvania's Roswell."
Thank you very much, Lou. Okay, exciting sounding story. Hey, Joe, look what you brought to our attention. Alrighty, I got to read up some more on that one and see if there's any relationship between the description of that object and what my family saw. But my family saw something in the sky that said that sat completely still for 20 solid minutes. A pair of objects that we were looking at with binoculars, and three members of my family, including me, saw it for those 20 minutes at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in August about 15 years ago. Okay, the next person with a question was Craig. Kilo Delta 2 Charlie X-ray Kilo, I think it is, Craig. Craig, go right ahead with your question, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Question. 1983, Dick. Saw the same thing.
Say that again, saw the same thing. Give me those call letters, or who said that?
Yeah, this is Joe number 2, KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Yeah, if you guys do a Google search, back in 1983, there was a lot of, there was like 7 lights up in the air in Westchester County, and there was a lot of sightings of that, and they were just going all different directions, and me and 8 of my neighbors saw that too up over here in Westchester County. If you do a search on that, and then we can always talk about it next week. But that's pretty cool, you know, that you guys experienced the same thing. All right, back to you.
Political mystic. I haven't forgotten you. Joe, give us a couple of words. In 1983, if you were an eyewitness, give us a couple of words. What did you and your family see in 1983? KC2QYW, K2RW in the tech man.
Yeah, Roger that. I believe I was in like maybe sixth grade, and it all started out that one of our neighbors saw it, and then, you know, the way they were acting about it and everything, we 100% believed them, you know? And then every night we would just, you know, hang out at the park down the street from us. And that park is facing towards the Long Island Sound that way, and that's where we saw it. It was about like 6 or 7 of them. They were all lined up, horizontal, and one will just move all different ways, and then go back up, you know, to the other ones, whatever. And then the other one would take a turn, and then the other one would take a turn, and I couldn't believe it, you know. Like back then, there was no cell phone, so, you know, we couldn't take a picture of it, and a police officer pulled over and looked at it too, and after a while, he told us to go home, you know. So it was a pretty cool thing.
Joe number 2, roughly how long did the event occur? And was this nighttime, daytime, dusk? How long did it last, and roughly what time of day did you see this, Joe? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I told my friends I'll be right back. I have to use the bathroom, whatever. So I went to the bathroom. One of my friends came. I swear to God, he came running up the stairs. And he says, Joe, you gotta come out, and you gotta see this. And I heard car horns going off. I guess people were like being scared, they were beeping car horns. I don't know, but like I heard like horns going off outside. I said, what the hell's going on? So I ran, you know, down the street, couple houses down, and looked up in the sky, and it was at nighttime, and maybe a good like 11:30 or 12:30 at night. And, yeah, it was in the newspapers the next day. It was in the newspapers, and I wish I would have saved the newspapers, the reports about that stuff. Back to you.
Fine, Joe. If you want to give us a little bit more of a description next week, it's an exciting subject. I'd like to hear a little bit more about it. So yours was a nighttime sighting, and mine was a daytime. Craig is the next person here. KD2, Charlie, X-ray, Kilo. Go right ahead with your question, Craig, and then after that we'll go to Wes. You got it, Craig, K2LIW.
Good evening, Dick. Just a quick comment on the past subject, as I'm involved in the astronomy community and the astrophysics community in New York. The consensus is NASA and the government love the fact that Americans believe in UFOs. It distracts so much from the actual things that they recover, which for the most part are either spy satellites, experiments gone wrong, or what have you. It just cleans up their whole story. Second thing, any intelligence capable of creating a vehicle that can travel faster than light or alter time-space to travel faster than light is not going to come all this way just to burn up in our atmosphere. On that note, let me go ahead and drop. That brings us all the way over to the VFO inside my Yaesu FT-817, which the knob came off, and I discovered it took the shaft with it. So since I'm somewhat inclined, and as many people are, a hobbyist of electrical engineering, I attempted to disassemble the VFO, I guess, body. Inside, I found the optical encoder wheel, the, I guess, the encoder board, and the place where the shaft goes. I reassembled it, yes, in the right direction. It only kind of goes together one way, and made it nice and tight and smooth, lubricated it with the proper grease, which does not deteriorate the plastic, reassembled my radio, and voila, it worked. Except, I'll let it drop again. It now works in reverse. When I turn it counterclockwise, the frequency increases. When I turn it clockwise, the frequency decreases. Now, the average person would say, well, I put something in backwards, either the cable or the encoder wheel. So I disassembled it again. Sure enough, it is assembled correctly. It can only go in one way. And the cable is keyed, so it can only plug into the faceplate board one way. But the unit operates backwards. I called Yaesu. They've never heard of such a thing. I went on the QRZ and posted a question there. Nobody seemed to reply. Nothing of any material. It is a COBOL VFO encoder, as Yaesu uses in many equipment. What would cause this? That is my question to Tekka.
A little bit amazed that Yaesu didn't have a suggestion on this one. I think I've got a guess on this one now. If you study by way of Google or other techniques, how does an optical shaft encoder work? At first you would say, gee, I create this wheel with a whole bunch of fine spokes, and now I've got some light shining through those spokes, picked up by an optical detector, and every time the wheel turns 1 degree, in my example, if I had 360 spokes, every time the shaft rotates 1 degree, one of those spokes would wave in front of the optical detector, and the optical detector would say, yes, you've moved 1 degree. That's the good news. But now, how in the world do you tell the difference between clockwise and counterclockwise rotation? The way they do it is they've got a very specific pattern of those spokes, and they have not one photodetector, but two photodetectors. The two photodetectors are offset a little bit so that as one of the photodetectors is getting full blockage of a spoke, the other one is only getting a quarter of the blockage. And in fact, in some cases, I think there are three photodetectors, but it can be done with two. But one of them is getting a partial blockage, which is increasing. Another one is getting a partial blockage that is decreasing. That's the one to the left, to the right, and the center one. And the center one is seeing the full blockage of the spoke. So with the right distribution of optical detectors, looking at multiple spokes of the opaque objects on the optical shaft encoder, you can tell how fast you've rotated, how far you've rotated, and whether it's clockwise or counterclockwise. Let me drop. However, the way it tells clockwise versus counterclockwise is an extremely subtle offset of the optical detectors. With a very minor shift to the right or left, so to speak, of the optical detectors or the axis of the shaft, with a very minor mechanical shifting. What becomes clockwise looks like counterclockwise because instead of a clockwise turn, the middle one is fully blocked, the left-hand one is going unblocked, the right-hand one is becoming blocked, so to speak, so it can tell the rate of change of the optical detectors, and therefore it can sense clockwise versus counterclockwise. With an extremely minor shift mechanically of the detectors or the shaft position, clockwise will look like counterclockwise once you understand the method by which it detects. It's this partial blockage and the rate of change of the partial blockage of the left versus the right-hand detector. I wonder if that makes a little bit of sense, Craig. And once you understand the way it works, you now can look with a magnifying glass or a microscope or whatever, you can take a finer look. I think you're going to discover that the optical detectors probably have egg-shaped holes where they can be moved a couple thousandths of an inch to the left or to the right. The wheel of the shaft encoder, maybe it shifted a little bit on the way it's mounted to the shaft. Maybe the way you remounted the shaft and the way you tightened the set screws
move the optical shaft a little bit off to one side versus the other. It's a very subtle alignment procedure required for the optical shaft encoder to work correctly. Let's see if that makes some sense, Craig. KD2CXK, K2LIW in the TechNav.
Mystic.
Oh, stand by there, Craig. Maybe John has already been there. John, I bet you run into this. KC2WGB, K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. The only thing you didn't mention, Dick, is the source lamp, the source of illumination. It's possible that could have shifted. I've had that happen before.
Oh. So in other words, the source lamp shifting. Now, by way of parallax, you've got a beam of light coming from the source lamp, aiming through these spokes of the optical interrupter, going into the photodetectors on the far side. So with a very subtle shift of the lamp, clockwise becomes counterclockwise. Ain't that crazy, Craig? KD2CXK. And by the way, as you fix this, come back to us and tell us what you had to do to make it work right. K2LIW and the Tech Man. You got it, Craig.
If you took your cue, the suggestion.
Okay, stand by, Craig. We got another one here. Hey, Glenn, what would you do in this case? Wait for the full beam.
I've actually played with a couple of units where I've had this problem, where disassembling a radio to clean it and then putting it back together again, and the VFO went backwards. And how I resolved it was I wound a way to reflash the memory inside the machine. Usually there's like a three-button procedure that you press, and it resets all of the firmware inside the machine again back to all of its default values, and resets everything, and then everything spins in the right direction. But I've had this happen before, not by, you know, the knob coming out or anything like that, but just, you know, by taking apart the unit to clean it, putting it all back together again, and then saw this, and then just did that, the old three-finger salute to reset everything, and then everything went back to normal. KC2QIQ.
Another beautiful suggestion. Many of the rigs, I'd like to believe the modern rigs are not as sensitive, and an 817 is pretty modern. But in the case of my Kenwood rigs, whenever I've taken them apart to replace a light bulb for the signal strength meter or things like that, whenever I've taken the front panel out, even though I thought I was careful, I was creating electrostatic voltages by the movement of my hand and the fact I'm touching the boards and whatever. And in roughly half the cases of the rigs that I've taken apart, the microprocessor went crazy. In other words, the static discharge from my fingers created phony commands in its memory, and it started acting really weird until I did a total microprocessor reset. You read your owner's manual quite often. You hold the on-off button while you hold some particular button while you're turning it on and off, or you press a particular button somewhere, or there's a hole somewhere where you put a straight pin through. There's various ways of reset, so that's another thing worth considering, Craig. And when you find out which one fixes it, let us know. KD2CXK, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KD2CXK. Okay, just a couple of notes on everything that has been discussed in the past few minutes. I have done several hardware resets on the machine, completely nuking it, to no avail. Let's see. This type of optical encoder is not a refraction encoder. It is a reflection encoder. There's a single circuit board on the unit in the back, which contains two pairs of transmit and receive optical detecting units. The wheel is a plastic disc approximately an inch across with several, which I did not count, prisms on it. I don't like little triangles with mirrors behind them. So there's nothing that can be knocked out of alignment, but it seems that something has happened. I guess the solution would be two things. One is actually a two-part thing. I either replace the Copella optical encoder with a new one, which is $50 plus extortion shipping from Yaesu, or is it possible that I can swap data 1 and data 0 wires, because there are four wires to this unit, positive, negative, data 1, data 0.
Interesting proposal. I suspect the answer is yes. I suspect if you reverse those data wires, the worst that will happen is it starts becoming erratic, but it could completely correct the problem. However, the Craig I know is enough of a scientist, he's going to want to know what in the world went wrong. Let me throw it out to the group. Anyone else have a suggestion about his reversal of the wires or other things that could be misaligned on this prism-like shaft encoder? If you've got some smarts in this area, please give us your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
WHSBBO.
Here's a guy who repairs equipment. Andy, have you run into this, and what would you do? The B2CDL, the guy who runs the tune-up clinic at each of the Limon functions, K2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, Andy.
Yes, the two things came to mind. One was what Craig just mentioned. If he unplugged this encoder, I'm not sure what kind of plug it uses to plug into the circuit board, the main circuit board. Did he plug it in the right way? Or directly to you, Craig, did you plug it in the right way, or is it a key plug where you can't reverse the wires? The other thing is that I've seen on the optical encoder two small trimmer variable resistors, sort of like a PC mount resistor. And if you look at the waveform, when you turn the optical encoder on a scope, the symmetry should be equal on both sides, positive and negative. It has to be balanced. Maybe for some reason the symmetry is backwards or it's not symmetrical at all, for whatever reason. And I've seen that problem. I've seen it where it works in one direction, but not in reverse. And that's because the pots were misaligned on the optical encoder, or the wires could be backwards if it plugs in. Two suggestions. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, the asker was Craig, and he did say that the connector is keyed and it can't be put in backwards. So let me turn it back to Craig. KD2CXK, K2LIW on TechNet. You got it, Craig.
Yeah, I think Andy may have touched on something. There are two very, very, very tiny surface-mounted pots on each side, one at 3 o'clock and one at 9 o'clock. It is very possible that during disassembly, single pressure may have altered one of these positions. So then I guess I can try and either tune it or reverse the wires. I don't have a piece of equipment capable of checking the waveform on these on the output of this encoder. So unless trial by error is could put me into a deeper situation, forcing me to buy a new one, I may try reversing the wires first. But that's a good point. Thanks a lot, Andy. I do appreciate that. That is definitely a possibility.
Yeah, I'm a little worried, Craig, that the setting of those potentiometers is a somewhat delicate operation. That if you're doing it with an oscilloscope, probably a dual-channel oscilloscope, where you look at the ratio between the two detectors as you're rotating the shaft, and then setting those pots, there's a particular waveform and symmetry of waveform you're looking for. You've done it with either a one or a two-channel oscilloscope, Andy. My guess is you're going to say it's a slightly delicate alignment procedure that with Craig just randomly moving those pots, the possibility of hitting in the right setting is not going to be easy unless you spend a whole lot of time. Therefore, the alignment procedure you used, Andy, is the right way to go. And so, Andy, what would you suggest for... I don't think you can easily do it with a digital voltmeter. I think it really requires an oscilloscope. WA2CDL for some comments. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, exactly. You really need a scope to see what's going on, to see if the waveform, and it should be a nice symmetrical square wave with even plus and minus voltages. And they have to be balanced. Now, I remember reading, and I forget which radio that I was working on, where they give you in the alignment procedure a way of adjusting those pots. And they actually tell you to connect the shaft to a small motor and run the shaft at a higher rate of speed, at a constant rate of speed, which you can't do with your fingers. Something that will keep it turning continuously, and then adjust those pots for the symmetry that you're looking for. That's kind of extreme, but that's the way they suggested doing it. Keep a constant speed on the shaft, so it's constantly producing that square wave, and then adjusting it. But that's what it sounds like. I have a feeling. Let me just let it drop a second. The thing that makes sense to me is, since you took it apart, you might have not noticed those pots, and you accidentally moved one with your thumb just by moving your fingers around the inside of the unit. So that would make logic and obvious sense, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's all it's required. Back to you, Dick.
What's your guess, Andy, if you were doing this alignment for Craig, assuming that he's got the unit disassembled, ready to go, and you're willing to set up the scope, and it's a two-man operation. One guy is slowly, continuously turning the knob, while the other guy is using a properly synchronized oscilloscope looking for that waveform. This is a Yaesu 817 that he's talking about. Are we talking about a 10-minute procedure or a two-hour procedure here to get it aligned? What's your guess, Andy? The B2CDL, K2RIW, and the Tech Man?
That's not a good procedure. It just takes a few minutes. In fact, again, is it Craig or Greg? I think it's Craig. What you can do is just turn the pot, turn one pot slowly and see what happens. Either it'll stop working completely, which probably will when you get to one extreme, in one direction, or also the other pot in the other direction. So you can play with it. You're not going to hurt anything. And if it stops working, just move the pot back. I mean, it's only a trim pot. It's only a one-turn pot. You can't go very far with it. And sometimes just by feel, you could just get it to work that way. You don't have to go to all these extremes. So it doesn't take long at all. Experiment. You can't hurt it. Dick?
Craig lives in Ridgewood, Queens, which is not too far from you. So I think your recommendation is that he do a little bit of experimenting, moving it very slowly at first to see if he can correct the condition. And if he's not able to find the magic setting of those two potentiometers, is there a possibility he could take the disassembled units over to your house? I'm volunteering your time, you know this, Andy. So, if he gets in trouble, is there a possibility that you might be able to help him? The B2CDL, K2RIW, and the Tech Man.
Yeah, that's not a problem. He's at a line. It's not a big deal. The thing is, you know, you really need a scope to see what's going on. Without a scope, you're just going by feel. It's, you know, a digital meter is okay, but depending on the rate of change, the resolution of the digital meter, you know, and how fast it captures, you know, it may be a little bit difficult. A scope is the best way because you can very easily see what's going on. So, another suggestion is if you can find the service manual maybe on the internet, which is a possibility, it could give you the alignment procedure, according to Yaesu, of how to adjust those pots for the right symmetry and levels that they're looking for. So that's something you could look for if you don't have the service manual. Most of the time it's in there, and how to adjust it. If there's a pot to be adjusted, it usually tells you what to do. Service manual usually tells you what to adjust. I'm just repeating myself on that. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, I'm getting the picture. Whenever you're looking at rising and falling waveforms on a digital meter, it's almost impossible. It can't do that. So there's got to be an oscilloscope operation for the serious alignment. My recommendation to you, Craig, is to do a little bit of camphole tuning, you know, a couple of degrees clockwise and counterclockwise in each one of the pots. Make some pencil marks or make yourself a diagram so you know the way the pots were set to begin with. You can always go back to ground zero, so to speak. So a little bit of gentle adjusting. I think there's a 50-50 chance you're going to hit it. If not, with Andy's oscilloscope and or the manual, the ASU 817 is a very popular rig. There's got to be guys out there with knowledge as to where to get the service manual and download it. There's probably even a website of 817. There's probably a users group of 817 owners which can give you some further suggestions. So it's not going to explode. Nothing bad's going to happen. The worst that will happen is that your shaft encoder will work backwards. To learn to use it the wrong way, I know it would be a pain, but there are people who have done that. And the nice thing about human beings, Craig, is they're very adaptable. You're one of those. One of the definitions of intelligence is the ability to adapt to a new environment. Thank you, Craig, for any final comments. And go for it. I don't think you can get into a great deal of trouble in this one, Craig. KD2CXK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I just want to say one more thing, Dick.
Okay, we heard you said you want to say one more thing, Dick. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, okay. The reason for the response in the first place is because of the mechanical misalignment. You know, this optical encoder is just a piece of plastic, usually. And it's not that precise. So to make up for the obscured optical patterns, you know, when they do these encoders, because they're not a precise machined unit, as so to speak. So they have to put those pots in there to make up for the electrical deficiency because of the mechanical deficiency. So the pots sort of fine-tune for the offset of the mechanics of it. And if you think about it, that makes sense too.
Yes, it does, Andy. Craig, for any final comments? And as you finally find the solution for this, Craig, please come back and let us know what you found. KD2CXK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KD?
Go ahead, John.
I think with increasing the frequency by rotating clockwise seems to be the way the radio should work. I wonder if it was incorrect to begin with. I believe he said if he turns it counterclockwise, the frequency goes up. Doesn't it sound strange to you?
No, I think it sounds very reasonable to go from one state. He knows the way the rig used to be before that shift came out of there. So he said counterclockwise makes the frequency go up, clockwise makes it go down. Was there another person from the outer area wants to sign in? I'm hearing somebody break in periodically. Who was that other person? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Alpha Yankee, Dick.
Okay, I heard Sierra Alpha Yankee very, very loud. If that's you, Doug, speak a lot softer and give us your information. WA2SAY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, it's WA2SAY. Yes, it's me. I found a service manual on the Internet. I haven't looked through it to find out if there's an adjustment for that, but I give you the URL here. It's ebookbrowse.com. Slant, ASU, hyphen, FT, hyphen, 817, hyphen, surface, hyphen, manual, hyphen, pages, hyphen, PD, hyphen, Delta, 225017391.
fuzz up. You are speaking louder than you need to be. Half of your words got dropped out. It's a very long URL. Tell us what search word you used to find that manual. Just tell us the path you followed. Did you Google a particular word, like Yaesu 817? Is that how you found it, Doug? W-A-2-S-A-Y, speak a little softer because you're jumping out of the machine. Or maybe it's the way that Don Eastern repeater works. In fact, I'll listen to you on the Eastern machine. W-A-2-S-A-Y, what was your search method? K-2-L-I-W. Go ahead, Doug.
Okay, I'll try to talk softer here. The search method was Yaesu 817 service manual. And the place I came up with is called eBook Browse, all one word run together, eBook Browse is where I found it. I'll copy now.
Okay, I was listening to you on the Eastern machine, and I heard you 100%. So eBook Browse, you did a search on Yaesu 817 service manual, and you found something, one word altogether, eBook Browse. Okay, sounds to me like you're going to be able to find that one, Craig. So with that service manual in hand, and with the spots we think we have given you, I give you a 90% chance you're going to get a cure here. And even if you don't get a cure, you've got a fallback mechanism by way of Andy. These hams help each other, Craig. KD2, Charlie X-ray, Kilo. And thank you, Doug. K2RIW. You got it, Craig. Craig, you still there? KD2CXK? Okay, maybe Craig got called away. Okay, Wes, into XJN. What is your mostly ham radio related, relatively brief question? I know that you get into some very heavy research of various kinds, which we should do after the mailbag and after the space net. Into XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, James. I'd say from your voice, you're afraid that I'm going to go to not really ham radio related. No. Telecom is the division of Israel Elbit Systems, and they are pretty much in secret military. SDR radios. So they have an orders, and orders are published, some of them at least. And they do the job mostly in RF power amplifiers. But occasionally Army or other entities, they sell those devices, probably absolute. So it is made for FM, but it is made also for software defined radio. Another question, very simple one. The frequency of 100 to 500 megahertz, the input voltage 28 volts, 10 amp maximum, power out is 50 dBs max, in parentheses 100 watts, and the gain is 45 dBs. Is operated with automated connectors, and the question is, what is the minimum input power to drive it out? Just by simple calculation from 45 to 40 to 45 dBs of gain.
Okay, for those who are not familiar with dBm, dB with reference to a milliwatt. 1 milliwatt would be, by the way, decibels are a logarithmic function. You take the log of 1, you get 0. So 0 dBm is not 0 signal. It means the reference signal, so to speak, 1 milliwatt. 10 milliwatts, log of 10 is 1, multiplied by 10, is plus 10 dBm. 10 milliwatts is plus 10 dBm. 20 dB dBm is 100 milliwatts, 30 dBm is 1,000 milliwatts, which is 1 watt filament. You go all through that jazz, you find out that plus 50 dBm is 100 watts. It's the usual engineering technique for indicating power on the decibel scale. If the amplifier has 40 to 45 dB of gain, let's take the worst case gain, 40 decibels of gain, and you want plus 50 dBm of output, that means you must drive it with plus 10 dBm of signal. Plus 10 dBm of signal with 40 decibels of gain, because of the way decibels add arithmetically, would, in theory, give you plus 50 dBm of output. And 5 dB below that would be a, let me think now, 6 dB would be a 4 to 1 ratio, 5 dB is probably a 3.5 ratio. So somewhere around 10 milliwatts down to 3 milliwatts, somewhere between 3 and 10 milliwatts is required to drive that amplifier to plus 50 dBm of output. If across that frequency range, it's got 40 to 45 decibels of gain.
100 watts out.
100 watts is plus 50 dBm. So if the numbers you've given me in dBm, 100 watts, 50 dBm is 100 watts, it suggests that plus 10 dBm of drive power should always be able to give you 100 watts of output or a little bit more. That's what the mathematics you've given me suggests, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Ben, said it's 40 milliwatts, that would be the driving power?
Negative. Plus 10 dBm is 10 milliwatts. So somewhere between 5 and 10 milliwatts of drive, which would be somewhere around 5 to 10 dBm. So 5 to 10 milliwatts, which is somewhere close to plus 5 to plus 10 dBm of drive power with 40 decibels of gain, gives you a calculated plus 50 dBm of output, and plus 50 dBm of output is 100 watts. So somewhere between 5 and 10 milliwatts of drive is required by the mathematics you've just given us, Wes, N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Is your spark generator that I have that operates from 10 MHz to 500 MHz that would be the driving the device for it? 200 milliwatts. My question is, what is the hold factor for what is the maximum that I can give it? I was asking for the minimum, because then I will overdrive it. As far as I remember, maybe John would know, the 3200B VHF oscillator from Hewlett-Packard. I don't see in here the, John has the same one. I don't see in here the power regulator, the output regulator, and to
engineer. I'm going to go over to John in a minute for some correction, but I'm going to tell you that most single generators have the equivalent of a power output meter, a set meter, in which you can get a calibrated amount of power output of the stage driving the step attenuator. Most single generators have a step attenuator, which you can now take a single generator, which I think you said is capable of 200 milliwatts maximum, and as you start using its output step attenuator, you can probably take that all the way down to a below a microwatt of power output, which would be minus 30 dBm, and some of them will go a hell of a lot lower than that. So once your single generator is in the calibrated mode, then with proper understanding of its front panel, you should be able to dial in plus 5 to plus 10 dBm of signal output, which is around 5 to 10 milliwatts. An amplifier that's rated for that amount of power input probably will not be damaged even if you went as high as 50 milliwatts of drive. If you went as high as 200 milliwatts of drive, and maybe your signal generator can go that high, now, in theory, you could create some damage, in which case you either want to be careful in the way you set the dial before you connect it and turn it on, or maybe you want to put a fixed attenuator after your signal generator just to be double darn sure you can't overdrive it. So since John is familiar with your signal generator, let's see what John's suggestion is. KC2WGV, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGV. You know what, I'm kicking that number around. I don't remember which generator that is.
This Wolman with the horizontal scale. Remember when I brought that staff from Long Island, I believe you got one and I got one. It's 3200B VHF Outlays. That was the deal for $15. Enter here.
Is that the one with the sliding attenuator in the rear?
Hold on. Yes.
You can adjust that for any output with that attenuator. You're going to need they make a meter for that. You just attach your meter to it, set it for exactly what you want. But make sure that the one you have is a 50 ohm output.
Well, I assume that the military grade amplifier is made by the certain standards. It was simply used for very much secure data transmission and voice transmission as well as unscrambled voice transmission. So, and that was the FM mode, as much as I was able to find. I was reading also one of the Army paper solicitation documents. And do it here.
Yeah, I got a suggestion here, John. Where there is a sliding attenuator on the output on the back of the machine, which sounds to me like it might not be calibrated, and you're worried about what impedance, if it's a coaxial output, it almost doesn't matter if it's 50 ohm, 70 ohm, or 90 ohm, a coaxial output, and a small amount of is wrong because it's got the wrong coaxial impedance, is a minor factor. If with the right fixed attenuator, just to be double sure he doesn't do any damage to his power meter, if he's got a power meter that's capable of measuring plus 10 dBm, 10 milliwatts, and he's reading the power meter after he sets the signal generator to the right frequency, and he slides that output sliding attenuator until he gets that power, then that would be a calibration procedure. See if your understanding of that machine fits that particular operating procedure, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Absolutely, Dick. It's a piston attenuator, and I'm pretty sure it's 50 ohm. I'm not positive, but I would have to look. I think it's a 50 ohm. So if he did that, he would be right on target. Or adjust it for maximum attenuation, hook up his equipment, and adjust it until he has the power output he requires. That's another way of doing it.
But what's the maximum power output of that generator? That generator is capable of 200 milliwatts, or plus 20 dBm, 100 milliwatts. That's getting a bit high, and there's a slim chance it could create damage to his 100-watt amplifier. Any idea what the maximum power is there, John?
200 milliwatts sounds high, but it could be. But with the attenuator all the way out, there's almost zilch coming out of that thing. That attenuator works extremely well. He just has to be careful.
Okay. To your knowledge, is he reasonably familiar with using a power meter, so that if he uses the power meter while he's sliding the piston attenuator, he'd be able to get it into the 10 milliwatt neighborhood of power output? Over to you for a comment on that one, John.
Yes, Dick. He's capable of